I am Julianne Good, and this is Psych One-on-One. Welcome. We are here to make psychology more understandable with tips for you, your family, and your friends to make your lives easier. How are you doing this evening? It is warm in Los Angeles. We hit about 90 degrees today, which was incredible. Anyways, I hope you are keeping warm in your part of the world. And tonight, my special guest is Terry Massey from the Chicago School of Professional Psychology of Los Angeles. We are going to be discussing the mentor programs for homeless women, particularly in the downtown Los Angeles area. Hi, Terry. How are you doing this evening?
Well.
Good. Thank you for coming on again. You were on my show about maybe a year and a half ago. So it's been a while, right?
Yes, it has.
Yeah. Been busy, right?
Always.
Yes. So can you tell the listening audience a little bit about your background?
My background. So I guess my background is basically in substance abuse. When the Chicago School came to Los Angeles, I was director of a program at California Graduate Institute, which they subsequently bought. And shortly after that, I stayed on and became director of the counseling center there at the Westwood campus. And then now in my current position as senior director of training for the downtown as well as Irvine campuses. So what I do is I oversee training for all the students that are going on practicum, the MFT students, the counseling students, and the PsyD students. So with that, another part of my role is providing training opportunities where they do not exist. And the reason for that is not only does it expose our students to populations that wouldn't otherwise have therapy, but it also provides a service to agencies that can't afford to hire psychologists and MFTs to provide services.
So it's a definite win-win for both the students and the agencies and, of course, the clientele, which is tremendous population in the downtown Los Angeles area alone, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you were recently involved in a conference called Closing the Gap Through Mentoring, Education, and Service on January 11th. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened at the conference?
Sure. So just as a bit of a background to the conference, the Chicago School we've had a mental health and substance abuse program at the Los Angeles Mission for the past 3 years. And the Los Angeles Mission is home to about 125 men in residence there recovering from homelessness, substance abuse, mental health issues, as well as about 20 women in the Ann Douglas Center of the Los Angeles Mission. And so what happened was, it was very interesting. Our president, Dr. Neilan Woods, along with Joseph Stevenson and our vice president, Jean Grant, did a site visit at the LA Mission. And while there, they met a woman who had graduated from the Mission program and was now trying to launch a flower business. And she came into the Ann Douglas Center with the most beautiful bouquet. And our president stopped her and spoke to her. And what she said was she was desperately trying to launch this business. She had a couple of clients that bought flowers from her regularly, but she didn't have a business plan or a space or anything like that. And our president was so impressed with her that she turned to Jean Grant and said, we should have a conference, a women's conference on homelessness. And that, and right then and there, the idea was planted. And so we began to plan for a women's conference. And what we did was we joined forces with the Ann Douglas Center and First Foundation Bank and began to look at what are some of the gaps in services for women who are able to get through a program of recovery, however, struggle when they leave the program. What is missing from treatment? And so we got together with a couple of other agencies. We did site visits of agencies, and we looked at the programming and decided that, you know, the best way to figure out what was needed was to poll the women. So our Concise Center at the Chicago School held focus groups with some of the women in residence. And what we found was that they were very much attached to the programs they were in and the people who are providing services, but were really unsure about what would happen when they left. They were concerned.
Well, most definitely. I mean, how long are most of the women, in the program anyways?
So for the Ann Douglas Center at the Mission, they're in there for about a year if they complete the whole program. Other agencies on Skid Row, it's anywhere from 3 months to a year. And for some, like the Downtown Women's Center, they are able to stay there indefinitely because they have housing on premises. So it varies.
So with this mentoring program, it was a day-long event, correct?
Yes. So the day-long event, the actual conference, which we held at the California Endowment, 140 people attended. It was incredible. Once the word got out, we had so many responses. We originally thought we would like to have 100, and then in the end had to ask for additional space to accommodate those that had registered. And so what we did was we had a strategic session where we brought together CEOs and directors of programs on Skid Row to see what they felt was needed in their agencies. And also we wanted to know what were they doing? What were some best practices that were working for them? And after that, we had two separate tracks, one for clinicians providing services in the agencies on Skid Row, and the other track was for women who were in residence in the various agencies. And that was a day-long process, which began at 10 a.m. and ended at 4. And so after each session, we polled the people there through post questionnaires to see if they were participating, whether they felt it was helpful for clinicians, whether the women in residence felt that what we presented to them was helpful, what were some of their concerns, what were some of the additional services they'd like to see in their agencies. And so at the end of the conference, we had a significant amount of data in which to look at.
And have you been able to sort through that data yet to come to some sort of conclusions as to, like, about the average age of the women who participated and how they came into the program? And have you been able to look through that data yet?
Yes. The average age we knew from the focus groups was early 50s. The data we collected at the day of the conference, as far as the ladies in residence went, what we found was that there were some concerns about them leaving programs. They were concerned about housing. They were concerned about leaving the only community that they felt being a part of. They were concerned about, you know, living back on Skid Row. What they learned there, would they be able to apply in their lives? There were really some significant concerns about leaving. And that's what we had thought initially. And so we were able to look at that and say, okay, so we have a gap here. So how do we stand in that gap and help them to achieve what they want so desperately? And that is to live productive, normal lives like everyone else. And so out of that, we thought, well, what we might be able to do is develop a mentoring program, utilizing women who have successfully navigated into housing and jobs and a sense of community, to utilize them to mentor the women who are getting ready to launch, who are getting ready to leave programs.
So what were some of the typical jobs that they were able to transition into? What kind of experience did they bring with them? Since they were in their 50s, I would imagine that they had put together quite a skill set along the years, correct?
Some of them had, not all. Some had been, you know, raising children and were housewives, and then, you know, through divorce, found themselves without the means to support their families. Others, quite a few, became victims of substance abuse and ended up on the streets. So it was more about what can we train them to do than, you know, what skills are they bringing to the table. Now, certainly, if we look at the woman who created those beautiful flowers, that was something that she discovered she had while there in residence. So creating an atmosphere where they can explore and really tap into some of their untouched potential is also something that's very significant and important in recovery.
Oh, yes, and especially if they have hidden talents that all of a sudden they start discovering when they're in residence. I mean, the joy I can imagine just, you know, unearthing some of the creativity that they may have buried because they're living on the streets and just trying to survive.
Yes, absolutely. And within most of the agencies, there are, you know, programs that help them get their GEDs if they need that, that provide job training, that provide help with getting employment. So all of those things are in place as well. And so the ladies and the men are able to, at the LA Mission, for instance, while they're in residence there, they're each assigned a job within the mission. And so they get to begin to work and be productive right off the bat within the first 30 days that they're there. And then the hopes are that they may find an interest there, whether it be in working in the kitchen or helping some of the case managers or janitorial or, you know, whatever it is that keeps the mission running as far as jobs go.
Do you know approximately how many people the mission can help? Because I know that there's a cap limit on that, correct? Is there, would you happen to know about the number?
Yeah. On the men's side, they have 125 permanent beds. And by that, I mean that can accommodate the men who will go through the year or the two-year program. On the women's side, they have about 20. However, they also have an additional 100-plus beds to people who are just there for the night, that come in, they get a place to sleep, they get a hot meal, they're able to get a change of clothes and a shower, and then they leave the next morning. So it's a significant amount of people that they help in the course of a year.
Right, and where in downtown is that located?
It's right on 5th and Winston. It's right there in the heart of Skid Row.
Okay.
Just to give you an idea, they serve over 2,000 meals a week.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
And why do they have less beds for the women than they do for the men?
Well, that's another, you know, really inspiring story. So originally, there was a very small part of the LA mission carved out for women, literally a couple of cots and not much more than that. And Mrs. Ann Douglas was touring the LA mission, and when she saw this, she went home and told her husband, we have to build something for those ladies. And so the add-on to the LA mission, the Ann Douglas Center, is now where the women are housed in tremendous dignity, in a place that really resembles a home.
That's beautiful. And for, you know, you said it was like a year program. Now, do they have to make a commitment up front, or at some point, can they just say, I can't do this, and then they just leave?
There's a large dropout, big dropout rate, of course, but they spend the first 30 days. The LA Mission is a faith-based organization, so they spend the first 30 days with their chaplains. And then at the end of the 30 days, they decide whether or not they want to continue in the year-end in the year-long program. And after that, they are actually able to stay another year and go into the workforce program for a total of 2 years. So
it is making a commitment and going through, you know, you go through this process, and then do they reassess you? Do they work with social workers and counselors? And
well, that's where the Chicago School comes in.
Nice.
So after the 30 days, during the 30 days, the Chicago School students have a group for the newcomers, and they kind of talk to them a bit about the services they'll be receiving once they enroll in the program. They talk to them about daily concerns they might be having. You know, it's a huge transition from the streets to a very structured environment. And some people adapt readily because they're so tired of the streets, and others put up some resistance because they're accustomed to running their own lives. So we're there to help during that transitional period. At the end of the 30 days, if they sign up for the LA Mission program, part of that includes attending groups with the practicum students that we have there. So we have substance abuse groups, we have process groups, we have trauma groups, and so that's part of their recovery. So when they begin, after the first 30 days, when they begin the year-long program, the first thing we do is provide comprehensive assessments. So we're looking at what might be some barriers to treatment. Are there any cognitive issues here? Are there any mental health issues that need to be addressed aside from the substance abuse, physical issues, medical issues? So we do a very comprehensive assessment, and then we sit down with the team of the practicums, the chaplains that act as case managers, and we present the case to them and say, these are some of the things that we think that this person might struggle with. These are some of the strengths that we've identified. And so from there, they're able to have a better understanding of the people they're working with. So for instance, if someone is suffering from depression, if we're not aware of that, they may show up for work and look like they're not interested, when in reality, they're suffering from depression. So it's helpful to get these things out in the open up front so we're better able to serve them and meet them where they are.
Right. What would you say a good candidate for doing the healing process, doing the program, what does he or she typically look like?
You know, Julianne, and you know, I have a history of working in addiction, and I would say that no matter where they're coming from, it's the complete surrender to, I can no longer do this on my own. And the willingness to let someone else help you. That really is what it takes.
Yeah, and for some people, that's really difficult to do because they have been so accustomed to living on their own and going through this life by themselves and pulling themselves up by their own bootstraps, basically. So that makes it challenging to, you know, get them to trust other people, especially strangers again, you know, especially from an agency, because I know I've worked with some homeless people and they had a difficult time with, okay, you're in that realm again, and this is what you're going to do. And I'm just a number here, and I already know this game. I know how this is played. And it gets very difficult for both parties to kind of do that breakthrough and build that trust and, you know, just start building relationship.
That's very true. That's very true. It does take a lot of trust. That's why the surrender, the ability to let go and let someone else in is extremely important, because they resist what they fear the most, and that is they're not going to succeed.
Yes, failure is huge. I agree. Terry, we're going to be back after the commercial break, and we will talk about what happened at the conference a little bit more, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
The Chicago School of Professional Psychology offers numerous psychology, behavioral, and health-related science graduate degrees at three campuses: Los Angeles, California, including branches in Westwood and Irvine, Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C., and online. The Chicago School prepares students to meet the ever-changing mental health needs of society through classroom experience and real-world training. The Chicago School Counseling Centers in Irvine and Westwood provide caring, confidential, and affordable psychological services to individuals and their families. For more information, visit thechicagoschool.edu.
And thank you to the Chicago School of Professional Psychology for sponsoring Psych One-on-One. This is Julianne Good, and I am back with Terry Massey. And we're talking about serving homeless women in downtown Los Angeles and the conference she was just involved with on January 11th called Closing the Gap Through Mentoring, Education, and Service. So, Terry, where did the inspiration come from to organize this conference?
Met the woman with the flowers and said, let's do a conference.
So it's as simple as that, huh? That's powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Which just goes to show that, you know, anything can happen when you least expect it, correct?
Correct. We did not set out that day to plan a women's conference. It was supposed to be a tour and a simple lunch.
It's turned into something much more significant, didn't it?
Yes, it certainly did. Yeah. It certainly did. But, you know, planning the conference was really, I think, collaborating with Dr. Jordan at the LA Mission and the ladies at First Bank, it was really a great experience because we all had the same thing in mind, and that was to do something that would make a difference, to really provide a venue where everyone could hear the voices of the women. That was most important to us because, you know, there are always meetings happening in Skid Row with some of the leaders down there. But there are a couple of programs where the women are able to voice their concerns or to have a voice in what's happening as far as treatment goes, but not a day that was planned for them. That has never happened. And it was so incredible to see them show up and to really take advantage of what was there for them and to enjoy themselves.
And to be pampered a little bit, right?
Pampered a little bit, yes, absolutely. And it was just incredible to watch them. You know, we did art therapy and we did mindfulness. And, you know, some self-care things that they were able to participate in. And we also did a communication class. And so they were able to talk about, you know, how difficult communication can be with loved ones and people in authority and bosses and things of that nature. And so they were able to identify, well, we need to do some more along the lines of communication. We need to provide more art therapy because they really appreciate being able to express themselves. So the whole time they were talking to us the whole time they were there, and that's exactly what we wanted. We wanted to hear them.
So what's one of the stories that you remember that really touched you?
To be honest, Julianne, I was running around the entire day. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't about a particular story. But it was about, I was sitting, this is a good story. I finally sat in on the mindfulness talk. It was Diana Winston from UCLA, who is one of the most sought after speakers in mindfulness in the country. And she was kind enough to donate her time. And so she was explaining mindfulness and the benefits of it. And one of the ladies said, if I practice that, will it bring me closer to God? And she said to her, and she looked at her and she said, I think it will prepare you to hear God's message.
Oh.
And the woman just lit up. It was so powerful in that moment to see her, you know, really wanting to use this towards something that was important to her and Diana being able to give that to her.
That's beautiful. You know, I'm sure that was, there were powerful moments all over the place just for the women being heard and honored like that. I mean, that's not an everyday occurrence. It's, you know, for them, it's probably healing for the self-esteem, healing for the heart, healing for their minds, and just, you know, hopefully with that, they can take another step forward. They can go another day. They can maybe be inspired to go a little bit further in their journey.
Yes, and to know that there is support outside of the programs that they're in, that there are other agencies and other women at agencies that are experiencing the same thing that they are, that their community is larger than the four walls they're in right now. And that was the other thing that we wanted to create, was an environment, a community of sorts that we'd be able to utilize in sharing resources. So if one of the agencies is doing a program on communication and the LA Mission is not, or Downtown Women's is not, can we send women to that program? If we're doing something on family reunification and Weingart is not, can they send their ladies over to LA Mission? So we really wanted to create an atmosphere of community amongst the ladies as well as the clinicians providing services.
So how many other agencies were involved with this then, other than Chicago School?
Wow, probably at their strategic session, about 20.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And some of the agencies that you have mentioned, I have heard of, you know, and it's nice for them to get together and collaborate and say, what can we do as a community? If one agency is, you know, filled with doing services on this line, maybe we can send you to this other agency and then have them talk to each other, because that's where things really start moving, is doing, you know, the counseling part of it, the social work part of it, just making the connections, building the bridges.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, Jean Grant and I toured a couple of facilities. We're still continuing to tour facilities we didn't get to before the conference, and learning more about what they're doing. It's really important. And there is some incredible work on Skid Row that social workers and MFTs and psychologists and students are doing, an amazing amount of work. And so we'd like to tap into all those resources and just create this sense of abundance. You know, when you think of Skid Row, you think of, you know, there's nothing down there, when in reality, there's a lot of abundance there, because people are dedicated to what they're doing, and there's a population that is grateful to receive services and to have help.
Yes, and they all come down to Skid Row from different stories, different backgrounds. I was amazed when I was hearing the stories of how somebody ended up being homeless. And it hit home for me that any one of us could end up with this happening, you know, depending on certain circumstances. So it's really heartwarming to hear that they're continuing to live, that they are continuing to thrive and do the best that they can with what they have.
Yeah. And we want to, you know, give them as much as we can as far as services go and as far as understanding what their needs are, and especially for women. I mean, there's no getting around it. Women on the streets are very vulnerable.
Yes.
Very vulnerable. Much more so than men. And so when they come into programs, they're suffering from trauma.
Yes.
And we need to be, you know, cognizant of that. You know, we need to employ trauma-informed care in everything that we do. We need to stop asking what's wrong with you and start asking what happened to you.
Right.
So we can better understand them.
More compassion.
More compassion.
And listening to their stories.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So how do women that live on the streets protect themselves?
You know, what we have, some of the stories that we have heard, first of all, some of the most vulnerable and some of the older women do not stay in the immediate Skid Row area. They go outside of Skid Row for safety reasons. And they'll come into the hub early in the morning for food and for any other resources that they might need. And then they go back to the outskirts. You know, if you drive around downtown LA in the evening, you'll see some of them on benches, bus benches that are very well lit outside of Skid Row. That's where they'll sleep so that they have a sense of safety with the light and with people back and forth. And so they are others that do stay in the hub are the ones that are subjected to providing services for a place to sleep. And you can only imagine what that includes. And also being constantly traumatized, being robbed, being assaulted, being raped. So the ones that have learned to go into the outskirts, they do that. For those that are addicted and need to be in the hub, it's a constant state of trauma, constant, and abuse. Mm.
What are some of the substances that are typical for people on Skid Row to be using?
I would say, especially amongst the women, it's crack cocaine and meth. Those are the two drugs of choice for the women, definitely.
Yeah, and that's horrible because I had one client in the substance abuse center that I work at that was telling me all the different ways that they cook up meth nowadays. And I was in shock. I just can't believe that, you know, people would be using that to get high, but you know, if it's cheap and it's available, they're gonna be doing it. So but yeah. That causes huge mental health issues right there. Just psychosis and just multiple problems. So how do the students work with people who are addicted to meth?
So, when they come in, for some that might need a higher level of care, like a medical detox, they have to be referred for that. That would be your heroin users and opiate addicts. But for those who are coming off of meth, usually after a period of time, they're able to stabilize. Some of them are put on antidepressants. If we send them for psych evals, because that helps. And others have been on medication. You know, part of substance use in that population is about self-medication as well. So, you know, it's hard to, and it takes time to weed everything out and find out what the real issues are. Is this truly an addiction or is this self-medication? And if we take this away, what have we got to replace it with?
Exactly. That is a great point, Terry. What are you going to replace it with? Because they've been using the substance as a coping mechanism for, it could be for years, and starting to take that away and then get down to the root of why they started in the first place is really time consuming. And sometimes they don't even know, you know, when you start taking it away, why did I start? I don't understand this. It was just there. It was available. I mean, sometimes that's what the story is. But as we know, as, you know, mental health professionals, there's always a reason for people to start using substances. And sometimes they're just at a point where they forget, and, you know, memory gaps and such. And so it's difficult. So it must be very challenging to go in for the students as a practicum site with working with the clients. So as the director of the training, what do you hear from some of the students that are some challenges for them?
Well, the first year we were there was a lot of crying. They were so overwhelmed. And, you know, we figured out quickly that this was really going to have to be a program that was extremely regimented as far as what we were able to do, and that we had to provide a very structured environment for the clients in order for them to feel safe. And so we started the groups. We started the Living in Balance, which is a CBT based life skills, substance abuse treatment curriculum. And then we started the Seeking Safety, which is a trauma-based group. And then we also, after initial assessment, began to identify those that would benefit from individual counseling, and the students started working with them individually. And I would say that that's where you would see the biggest change, because if they were able to, here they had a therapist, so to speak, practicum student, all to themselves. And so they had weekly sessions, sometimes twice a week, with the students. And so they were able to form relationships. And that's the first step in any recovery, being able to form relationships and being able to have someone that you can trust with your secrets. And so that was really helpful to them.
That's good. So what kind of training do you give the practicum students now that wasn't initially in place?
So it's more, so all the students coming in, we tend to take more advanced students there, second and third year psychology students. And so they've had the CBT training, they've been at other practicum sites. So they come in with a certain amount of training. And then what we do is we train them on the assessments they're going to be using. We present cases and have them discuss that. We have an interdisciplinary team meeting every week with the chaplains, the practicum students, and our psychologists there, Dr. Rush and myself and Dr. Jordan. And we talk about cases and we talk about what's working, what's not, what more do we need to do. So we're constantly reassessing, reevaluating, and adding. That's what we've been doing for 3 years now. Mm-hmm. And so there's a constant training going on within the context of the everyday services. And the students get to share with one another what's worked, what's not working. They, you know, they kind of work as a team in the best interest of the client. So there's a lot of collaboration that goes into this, a lot of collaboration.
And self-care.
And so, oh, yes. So we're always reminding them about self-care.
I know, which sometimes is easier said than done, but... And especially, you know, towards the end of the MFT program, which is a 3-year program now. It was 2 years when I was in, but it's that last year of, you know, doing the practicum hours and finishing up and taking the test and anymore. So, yeah, it's definitely challenging, but I tell you, it really gets you trained well for the real world of doing counseling. So I was very appreciative of what I ended up going through. And so it sounds like it's excellent training for all of your students, because this is, you know, a high risk, high maintenance population. And, you know, it's once they get all of that knowledge and the practical skills into place, it's going to make it so much easier for them to go out and take care of a wide variety of clientele. So that's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Just, you know, the diagnostic skills alone that they pick up there are incredible, because everyone is at least dual diagnosed, if not triple diagnosis. And so the students are constantly having to revisit diagnosis and make changes and to do assessments to, you know, solidify what they think is going on. And so it's a constant unraveling of a mystery of someone's life for many, many years on the street.
Yes, it is. And sometimes we only get to the surface and maybe a little bit further down. You know, you never know. We just, you know, we have to plant seeds as much as possible and do the help that we can while we have that person in front of us and they're under our care.
Yeah, yeah. And what's so incredible is our students, and I do as well, attend the graduation ceremonies. And so we're able to witness firsthand what a year has changed, how a year can really substantially change someone. And the ladies or the men get up at the podium with their chaplain, and the chaplain will read a verse from the Bible specifically for them. And the student will talk about their experience at the LA Mission and what they're now taking with them out into the world, which is this sense of belonging, sense of being cared for, sense of self-efficacy as far as what they've learned in the program. So it's really very incredible to watch the end result.
I bet there's a lot of tears shed there, aren't there? It sounds like it would be one of those ceremonies where there are not a whole lot of dry eyes.
Exactly.
That's great. That's wonderful. So we are going to take a break, and we are going to come back in a little while. Stay with us on Psych 101.
Therapy cable is the missing piece in the puzzling question, what is the role of the cyber world in healthcare? Therapy cable has created a marketplace where healthcare finally meets technology in a consumer-friendly way. We use online technology to bring together various entities of healthcare in one central place. It's easy to access from any internet platform. We provide educational videos on topics like acupressure, medicine, psychotherapy, and yoga. You can confidentially use this information in the privacy of your home. You can stay connected to the provider of your choice or even see your provider in person. Get started today at therapycable.com.
Welcome back to Psych 101. I'm Julianne Good, and my guest tonight is Terry Massey. So, Terry, the conference sounds like a launching point for the Chicago School to be working with homeless women and doing the mentoring program. What are the next steps that are going to be happening with this program?
So, right now, Jean Grant and I are still visiting a couple of sites. And we're going to be scheduling a second meeting of the agency leaders. Since now they have gone through a whole day at the conference, they have their own feedback from the ladies that were in attendance from their agencies. And we have the minutes from our first strategic conference at the day of our conference. And so we want to ask them what they think next steps should be. One of the things that they brought up was that they don't seem, as agency leaders and CEOs, they don't seem to have enough of a voice in politics. That decisions about homelessness and housing and all of that are being made at a higher level. and they are not involved in that process. And so we would like to figure out a way to have more involvement in that. And so, for instance, we are reaching out to Wendy Brule, who has now been assigned to look at homelessness in Skid Row. And we would like to meet with her and talk about our collaboration and also find out what some of our plans are and see if there is a space for us to have a voice there. The second thing would be the mentoring program. We would like to engage the alumni of the Chicago School to maybe meet quarterly with the people who have committed to the alumni program, just to see how things are going, to provide any educational trainings for them. And so that's something that we would continue to develop. And the third thing is specifically for the Ann Douglas Center, Dr. Claudia Shields, our chair of the clinical psychology program, has committed to working with a couple of MFT students at the LA Mission next year to develop a family reunification program.
Wow.
However, we're going to redefine family reunification to include not only extended family, but to include any place in the community with an extended family, within old friendships, where women can connect when they leave to have a sense of belonging.
Yes, to be able to go back and reestablish old relationships again, I'm sure would be phenomenal, because so many times, especially if they became involved with substances, those connections have been cut or you know, they think, you know, but a lot of times family and friends will say, well, you know, if you're staying clean, then yes, you can come back and let's start working on what we had before, because there's a longing to reconnect with your roots.
Absolutely. And so we're hoping to, it'll be, you know, a three-prong program, and the third part would be actually bringing some potential people into the LA Mission to meet with the ladies and discuss what it might look like to reunify after several years. So we'll work, you know, women by women, family by family, and try and create something so that when they leave, they have a built-in support system.
That sounds like a major amount of work, but definitely worth it. So what does the reunification program entail in just parts?
So right now, in looking at the research, all family reunification programs are about reuniting women and children. And it kind of stops there, at least as far as my research has gone. And so I thought, well, they have steps to reunify women with children, so we could kind of build on those steps and reunify women with people in the community and family members. So the first step would be, of course, getting the buy-in from the women who are interested in this, letting them know that you don't have to have children to partake in this. Mm-hmm. And then looking at some of the relationships that they would like to reconnect with, and really starting with a very extensive list and then narrowing it down to the ones with the greatest potential. And then once we identify that, begin to have the ladies write letters to those people, just letting them know where they are and what they've been doing. And within that process, look at, are there amends that need to be made? You know, what was the relationship like before? And then processing those losses with them as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so that's where we'll start. And then the final step will be bringing those people into the agency to actually meet with the ladies and talk about how they might move forward in relationship. So we're hoping to have them reestablish these relationships while they're in residence and solidify those that are more open to it, so that when they leave, they definitely have a support system in place that they can count on.
Yeah, the beginning of mending those webs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah, and that's for a lot of people. That's a little difficult. So that sounds like that alone is going to be a very challenging part of doing the therapy work down at the mission?
It will be, but, you know, we have to come from a strength-based perspective. So, yes, there are 40 reasons why this person might never want to talk to you again, and they all have to do with your behaviors as an addict, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But what are you bringing to the table now that might be interesting to this person to reconnect with? Because you were someone before the addiction, and you are now someone in sobriety.
Right.
And so let's build on those strengths and provide a place where they could build the confidence and self-efficacy enough to want to reach out to people, to say, I am no longer that person.
Exactly. You know, and time does heal part of the wounds also, because people change. And as long as people can say, well, that was who I was back then, and I'm sorry for the hurt that I caused you or anybody else, but this is who I am now, and let's try to rebuild this because I miss you.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly. And so what seems impossible then becomes possible slowly.
Yes, and there is hope.
And there is hope. There's always hope.
There is always hope. I agree, definitely. Terry, if any of the listening audience would like to contact you, how can they do so?
They could email me at the Chicago School. It's tmassi, M-A-S-I, at thechicagoschool, all one word, .edu. That's the best way to get a hold of me.
Okay, fantastic. And much success on this mentoring program and the continuation of working with the mission of downtown L.A. And you're doing a fantastic job that, you know, incredible work. I have known some of my colleagues that have gone through that program, and it was life-changing for them, and I'm sure it was life-changing for a lot of the clients, too. So that's fantastic. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Julianne. It's always good to talk about things that are so close to our hearts, isn't it?
It is. It is, most definitely. It's empowering. So thank you. Take care, Terry.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And if anybody would like to contact me, my number is 562-209-1837. You can also contact me at jgoode8@verizon.net. I'm also on Facebook at Julie-AnnGood and Psych One-on-One. And Twitter me sometime. That would be awesome. I would love that. So just contact me. Reach out. If you have any questions, comments, you need any assistance with anything, please do so. Please contact me. I'm here to help out. And I hope you take care of yourself. I hope this was a very informative subject for you, because we don't talk about this much, and we should be talking about this more, because, you know, a lot of us do know people who have ended up homeless, at least temporarily, and it is very traumatizing. But you can work yourself out of it. You can help other people. There is assistance out there. There's programs like we were talking about this evening. So just go find the resources and help somebody out today, okay? So take care of yourself and take care of each other. This is Julianne Good for Psych 101. Bye now.